You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
The Art History Babes are going to New York, and we want you guys to come with us. Spend 5 days in New York City, December 18th through the 23rd with us. We're going to hit all sorts of art museums, do some underground art things, eat good food, drink wine while staying in the same hotel. It's going to be magical. If you are interested, head to likemindstravel.com. It'll be linked below for you. And you can jump on the mailing list so you know when packages become available. And we hope to see you there. Also, in case you missed it, big exciting announcement. The Art History Babes are writing a book. We're totally stoked on it, very excited. But as you can imagine, a lot of work goes into writing a book. So if you would like to help fund our book writing and essentially make it so we can keep releasing content consistently while we write, please consider becoming a patron. Patreon.com/arthistorybabes. Every dollar helps. We very much appreciate our patrons. You guys are the best. If everyone that listens to the Art History Babes regularly donated even $1 a month, we would be in a pretty legit position. So if you can afford to help even just a little bit, we really, really, really appreciate it. And we really appreciate all you guys. Got another throwback episode for you, originally released on October 30th, 2017. Please enjoy this episode on our favorite 15th century weirdo, Hieronymus Bosch.
The Art History Babes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Nat.
I'm Ginny. And we are the Art History Babes.
We're the Art History Babes.
Oops. That was nice.
New jingle?
Like a fade out.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Why not?
Yeah, why not? Banter. We're supposed to banter at the beginning of these things. What do we have to banter about?
I have something.
Yeah, banter. Yeah.
Recent coincidence. So my best friend from high school is living down in Long Beach, and she was just telling me that her new roommate, shout out to Marissa, we have not met, nice to meet you, is a listener and didn't know that we were friends. So
that is a small world situation.
And like, let me also say, my friend, yeah, she goes to Long Beach, but she works for SpaceX and she's in finance. So it's not even like she's like in the arts and this is like an, oh, well, of course, like, no.
Yeah. Not at all. Yeah.
This is a very, very random coincidence. Yeah. So
that's super dope.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks for listening, Marissa. Excited to meet you at some point.
Hey, Marissa.
Does she have like a background in art? Is she into art?
I don't know, honestly.
Well, come on the show.
Like 2 nights ago. I know that she's interested in podcasts and podcasting potentially. So I said that any question she has of that nature, that we would be happy
for sure
to give her our sage advice.
Yeah, if she has some kind of topic she'd want to discuss, like come on.
Yeah.
Come on to the show.
Just gonna eat an oat cake.
Can you guys tell this is our second recording in one night?
Yeah. we're at that tipsy point, which I mean that's when shit gets fun. Like
it
let's
is.
Be real.
Plus, like we did a lot of fun things in between. Like we watched that video of the bat. And okay,
Daddy.
So there's a video that you have to watch if you haven't seen it. Just type in like bat flies around Irish family kitchen. And it'll come up, and it's the most amazing thing. Like, this little bat is trapped in a kitchen, and the son is, like, filming his dad trying to catch it, like, narrating, and he has, like, the best Irish accent of all Irish accents I've heard.
It almost seems fake.
I know, because when I heard it at first, I was like, what?
Yeah.
Like, it's just so, but it's so
but
fucking
funny.
The bat
is real, guys. You can
the
see
bat
it.
Is,
the bat is very real.
And I love bats. So
bats are fucking cool.
Yeah.
We have friends. Did you see Face and Fall?
Bats and Brew or Bruinbacks.
Or... Yeah, I want to go to that immediately.
No, it's not far from here.
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah. I would love to drink and check out some bats. That sounds fucking dope.
We get bats over at my parents' place. My cat caught one and brought it inside one night, and my mom was pissed.
Yeah.
So you can get us some bats, is what you're saying?
I could get you some bats. Just put my cat Cappy on it, and she'll get you some bats.
Just tell Cappy, no kills, Cappy.
Yeah. She really likes the torturing aspect, so I'm sure she'd bring it back alive. Yeah, I know. She's such a lover, but she's so sadistic at the same time. It's very weird for me to come to terms with.
Cats, man, seems
normal.
That's very normal. Yeah. Cats, I love them because they're fascinating, but like
they're tiny little sadists.
Yeah, they really are. You can't go to a cat for the same comfort you would get from a dog.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Cappy's pretty good. Like, she's kind of close. She's super cuddly. That's what's weird. But my other cat's kind of a bitch, so you would expect her to be, like, the killer. But Cappy's, she's all of it. She's extremes. She's a lover and a fucking murderer.
But even with cuddly cats, because I've definitely had my share of experience with cuddly cats, and I appreciate cuddly cats, it's a different vibe from the dog. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
the cat will cuddle you, which is great, but it's like... There's always that general understanding of, like, I'm fine without you.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
She's completely fine.
Dogs' worlds, like, literally center around you.
Yeah.
You're, like, the epicenter of all that they know. Mm-hmm. And for that, they're eternally grateful.
I read this thing.
There's the occasional asshole dog, it's true.
Oh, yeah. I read this thing, and I don't understand, like, animal science is so fascinating to me because I don't understand how they actually know these things, and part of me is very skeptical, but I love it anyways. But I read this thing that, so dogs, the way their brains work,
mm-hmm.
when they see humans, they register that humans are different from them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it registers in their brain that it's not the same thing as a dog. Like, so basically to dogs, they see us, they're like, you are different, but I love you.
Yeah.
Right? That's basically like a dog's brain reaction. However, cats think that humans are just dumb cats.
What?
Yeah. So basically what registers with cats is that humans are similar to baby cats. And that's why they bring us dead bats and rats is because they're trying to teach us how to hunt.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So essentially dogs are like, you are different and I love you. And cats are like, you're a big dumb baby. Isn't that interesting?
It is interesting.
I was like, it makes sense, but it also, like, kind of says a lot about how, like, dogs and cats react. Because dogs do, like, love you unconditionally. And there is this feeling with cats, I think, often where they carry themselves like they're superior to you, you know? Mm-hmm. And so this idea that cats
That's why it's so funny when they fuck up.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just spent, like, a good, like, 30 minutes the other day with my boyfriend watching cat videos. And, like, I don't know the last time you guys watched funny cat videos, but...
No, I love
my
it.
My God.
When they...
so funny.
When they think they're, like, when they're really confident about something and then they, like, fall or something.
Yeah,
it's hilarious.
Glorious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But with, like, a dog, like, that's not as funny. It's like,
sweet baby.
Yeah.
So it's like, we kind of think about them almost in the opposite. Like,
yeah.
We think dogs are just kind of like, I mean, I don't want to say we think dogs are dumb, but they need more nurturing.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
And cats, you're like, you're fine.
You've got this.
Yeah.
You don't need me.
You've got how many lives left? You're good.
Yeah. Well, cats were the first animals to, like, they came to humans to be domesticated because they're fucking smart.
Yeah.
They were like, oh, I'm going to go to these humans and they're going to feed me.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a pretty solid deal.
True.
And so they, like, approached humans, and then that's how they became domesticated. So it was really, like, them just being really smart.
I was going to say, so basically cats are in control of everything.
Probably.
If you have a cat, you think you're in control. Think again.
Yeah. Wrong. Incorrect.
So, segue.
Yeah. Today... We are going to talk about our good dear friend, Hieronymus Bosch.
Yeah.
Oh, Hieronymus.
Hirani.
He is something. He was quite the dude. He was, I don't know, in so many ways, very ahead of his time. He was just doing weird shit.
I think that's a lot of why people love him.
Yeah.
Because, like,
yeah.
Whenever you see something... Like, on a much smaller scale in terms of fame, like when we did the Helma F. Klint episode where it was just, like, she was so ahead of her time.
Oh, yeah.
And that is a lot of what's making her more popular. Sorry, I burped. more popular now. But, yeah, I think with Hieronymus Bosch, it's like, damn. He was making that then. Like,
yeah,
it seems so crazy.
And aesthetically, that's what's kind of interesting, too, because his figures and his work, they have, I mean, technically he was around in the Renaissance, but his work has a very, like, medieval feeling to it. Mm-hmm. So it's like you're looking at work that looks decidedly medieval, but it's so weird and so not medieval, you know? Yeah. So it's like, what was happening with this dude?
Yeah.
He was a creative son of a bitch is what he was.
Yeah.
For real.
Hieronymus. I also heard it pronounced Hieronymus, which I don't
we're, we're, to that one.
We're not going to do that. But he was presumably born in 1450. We don't know exactly because there isn't a lot of historical record on this.
Yeah, year. There's really not. Yeah. I was interested to see that. I saw, did any of you come across something saying that his real name was Gerowen van Aachen?
Yeah, I heard he went by many names.
Yeah.
But there's multiple names.
Yeah, because he came from a family of painters originally from Aachen, Germany.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's gone by several names, Hieronymus, and then, I don't know how to pronounce it, Hieronymus with a J at the front, Hieronymus.
Hieronymus.
And then Jerome, and my personal favorite, Geronimo. Yeah.
Interesting.
J-E-R-O with a little accent.
Yeah.
N-I-M-O.
Wow.
Geronimo.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
So he's a man of many names.
Yeah. And not a lot of information.
Yeah. So yeah, it's pretty much believed that his last name was actually Van Aachen, but where he gets the Bosch, this is a very common thing for medieval and Renaissance artists, is it comes from his hometown, a Flemish town called Hertogenbosch.
German.
I don't know if that was remotely correct, but Hertogenbosch.
I think it's Sertgen. Just because I heard it pronounced by someone earlier and it sounded so subtle that I wouldn't have guessed it's that many letters, I feel like they, like, really limited it down.
Yeah.
One or two sounds.
Well, Bosch is at the end of it.
Yeah. So think Da Vinci. I mean, that's the best way to equate it. Leonardo da Vinci's name comes from the town of Vinci in Italy, where he's from. They're pretty much contemporaries. I think Da Vinci was born in 52?
I don't remember, but yes, totally.
They're contemporaries. Yeah. They're born around the same time.
Yeah.
Different locations, different lives, but...
And that's, just a very common thing at that time, is your last name derived from where you were from.
Yeah.
And then if you become the most famous, you get to own it.
Yeah.
There are not a ton of Da Vincis out there. He's not the only person from Vinci. Just like there aren't a ton of Bosches.
Yeah.
As far as I know. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe there are more Bosches.
I don't know.
Never heard of Bosch.
I feel like, isn't Bosch the name of, like, an appliance? I don't know what kind, but I know that it is.
People tend to think, just from his style and the fact that the Prado in Spain owns a lot of his work, people tend to think that he was a Spanish painter.
Mm-hmm.
Not true. From the Netherlands.
Yeah.
Yeah, he grew up in the Netherlands. And as we said, there's not much record of his life, which kind of adds to the mystery of his work.
For sure.
On top of the fact that his work is really weird and mysterious, too.
Yeah.
But then not having the background information kind of just adds to that. He once again presumably died in 1516 during an outbreak of the plague. No record that he actually died from the plague, but there was an outbreak of the plague in the area he lived in at this time, so maybe he died of the plague.
So I saw an actual date for his death somewhere. Do we think that that maybe is just fabricated, or...
I don't know.
I know that his birth is definitely, like... I've seen in a lot of places there's, like, a five-year span where they're, like, it could have been, like, anywhere between 1450 and 1455.
Yeah.
Technically, it could have been anywhere. Were in there, but I saw August 9th, 1516.
That is very
exact. I know.
That's very exact.
Yeah, because one of the articles I found was like commemorating his, whatchamacallit, 500 years after his death.
Quintennial?
Thanks, guys. The quintennial anniversary of his death.
Yeah, that did just happen.
It would have been last year on August 9th.
I definitely know that happened in 2016, which I'll talk a little bit more about. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's one of the, like, because I did read sources that didn't give a definite date and kind of suggested that it was...
And there's been varying ones, too. It seems like there's a lot of debate in terms of, like, certain dates in his life and, like, what he was doing at this time.
Yeah.
And,
but, I mean, we can go with that. August 15, 16.
Sure.
That's when he passed on.
Went on to the Gardens of Delight.
When he passed away.
Delightful shit.
Yeah. Very delightful.
He passed away. I don't know why in certain contexts saying, like, pass away. Like, where was I? Like, last weekend, and there was some guy that was just like, you know, sometimes when it's so hot like this, I just worry I'll pass away. And he was like 20-something years old.
Was it Paul? Paul uses that all the time.
Paul also says that. Does Paul?
Paul and Faith always, they throw in just pass away in a really,
yeah,
like, weird.
See, you know. I feel like that would, like, not offend me, but, like, catch me off guard. Whereas,
I think that's why
I
would
die. I think because Paul
has
said it so much that, like, to me it's somewhat more normalized.
Yeah.
Or, like, I just assume
I've not
when
heard him
someone
say that.
It's so funny.
Yeah. Treating it tenderly because it actually happened.
Yeah.
But, like, when you're talking abstractly, usually people are just like, I'm going to die.
I know,
yeah.
But
D-I-E.
This heat will make me pass away.
Oh, when I pass away.
Makes you think, doesn't it?
And Hieronymus Bosch thought about passing away a lot.
He sure did.
Good segue.
He thought about it.
I'm sorry, Bosch.
You would appreciate that.
Yeah. So, okay, in 1463, so Bosch would have been a youngin at this time, there was a wildfire that swept Den Bosch, where he lived, which shows up in his work. He deals with these really cool silhouettes of fires in some of his works that are really, once again, ahead of their time. I don't know, the type of thing I think you could only really reproduce if you had experienced something like that, like being caught in your town literally ablaze. So that is something we know about his history that does show up in his work.
Yeah.
As Jenny said, he came from a line of painters, his father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and many uncles. All of them liked to paint. He was respected in his community. He married wealthy, basically. So he wasn't bad off, and then his wife was wealthy as well.
Right.
So he, respectable marriage, you know.
Yeah. He did well for himself.
Yeah.
Seems like he reached up a little, like he just climbed up a couple steps on the social hierarchy.
Definitely. He made his life work for him. He was a member of the Brotherhood of Our Blessed Lady.
Yeah.
Which worshipped the Virgin Mary, which was...
Brotherhoods and confraternities are so interesting.
We should do an episode.
We should.
There's a real culty vibe around it that you kind of gotta get past and not be judgy, but first instinct, when you hear of, like, any brotherhood, you're slight raised eyebrow.
Just groups of men, like, getting together and doing...
Like, really interesting rituals.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of how I feel about fraternity.
Yes.
Sororities.
Definitely.
But, yeah, I mean...
No, Greek life is a fascinating thing.
Ooh.
I bet you we can...
It is.
We could do Greek life, like, art history angle. I think we could probably do something there. There's a lot of symbols and, like,
Email us if you have any ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could do some research on this. I got some contacts.
I talked towards the computer and not the mic, like a confused 80-year-old person. Like, I've recorded so many episodes, and I just, like, pushed my face up to Corey's computer. I just did it again because I was showing you, but seriously.
Or maybe just a, like, slightly drunk person. That could be it, too.
I hope not. I need to drive.
But if any of our listeners are part of the Greek world and have some interesting insights to just symbols and art and stuff, I think that could be a really fun investigation.
Symbolism? Ritual?
Yeah.
There's a lot there.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot there. And then just the contemporary existence of Greek life. It's taken on its own thing now. So, yeah, that would be cool. Email us.
You guys do a lot of crafts? They do crafts.
I keep thinking of those paddle things. They have to decorate paddles.
They're crafty.
They are very fucking crafty. Those sorority girls, man.
They're busy people. They're always doing like volunteer work and stuff. They
for them.
Always got events to go to. So I mean, like, hats off to you. But yeah, it's a fascinating thing. So
can you tell none of us were in recon?
My college had like two sororities.
Anthropological studies. Oh no, this is the best. My college didn't have Greek life because there were like 2,500 people at the whole school.
Oh really?
Yeah, it's a very small university. But my senior year, someone started one sorority and one fraternity called Gale Sisterhood and Gale Brotherhood, and I was just like, cool.
Going for it.
I had just seen the ins and outs, not the ins and outs, but I had seen enough of Berkeley Greek life that when I saw them doing this, I was like, aw, guys, this is so cute. Like,
Greek life was actually really big at both of the undergrads I went to, so I went to Iowa State for a while. Greek life is fucking huge there, surprising.
Sure.
And then I transferred to University of South Dakota. Greek life is very big there as well, so it was always a big thing. And I thought about doing it for like 5 seconds because I came out of high school, like I was on dance team in high school, and it's very, in some ways, very similar. Like you're super tight with your team. You have sleepovers. You have
we do volunteer work.
Yeah.
I think a lot of at big schools like that, a lot of athletes don't feel the need to get into Greek life because it is in its own way. Like athletes are the same.
Sure.
Have their own
unit. Yeah.
Exactly. They operate in a lot of the same ways as Greek life.
Yeah. And so coming out of high school and that being such a big part of my life, I was like, hey, maybe just having a house full of
friends.
Ready-made friends would be nice.
She used the term ready-made. She is an art historian.
Yes.
Don't forget it.
Anyways, Greek life, while none of us actually partook, I mean, I went to some parties.
I went to some at Davis when I was an undergrad. I didn't go to Davis for undergrad, but I had friends that went there for that. And I remember going to a nautical-themed party at a fraternity. And I was not in theme, nor was my female friend. Our male friend was not in theme. And the guy at the door was like, you're not even in theme, bro. Literally, I'm not even exaggerating. And our friend was like, well, I guess I'll go to In-N-Out. I'll see you guys in a bit. And we're like, no, like, we just want to go.
Get on theme.
Yeah. Get on the theme wave.
But yeah, after this long rant, if you have any interesting insights into the visual culture of Greek life, we would be interested. Or the ritual culture of Greek life.
Yeah.
I think that could be a really cool investigation.
I think so too.
Let's get back
to the brotherhood.
To the brotherhood of Our Blessed Lady, which worshipped the Virgin Mary, which is also interesting to me that it was a brotherhood worshipping the Virgin Mary.
Yeah, there's a lot of those. Or were. There were a lot.
I mean, Catholicism fucking love Mary.
They love the Virgin.
Which it's complicated. It's complicated
as
hell.
It really is.
But on some level, like I said, as someone who grew up very Catholic, I do appreciate the fact that you have a strong female image, at least.
For sure.
You know,
the
not
problem
that.
The is that she's completely desexualized. Yeah. And that's the reason that she's appreciated. Yeah. That's the one caveat.
Oh, definitely. Right. No, it's a problem. It's definitely a problem. Yeah. The desexualization of her, she's a virgin, like all of that. Super fucking problematic.
The reason why she's.
Yeah. But still, being a small child, it is just good to reinstate the idea that a woman is worthy of worship, I think, important. So there are...
Jesus respected his mom, guys. Respect your moms.
Yeah, respect your moms. Just the Mary characters in general, like Virgin Mary, Mary Magdalene, like it's all very interesting.
I know. Could do an episode on that, too.
We could,
man. We could do an episode on the Da Vinci Code.
And I will
not read or
speak
seen.
With flames flicking from my tongue.
I haven't read it, and I haven't seen the movie.
I've seen the movie.
You guys should read it. You should read it.
Yeah, it's entertaining.
No, you really should read it.
I started trying to read the other one, Don Inferno or whatever, his one that takes place in Florence, and I was like, oh, I can't.
No, like, I promise you.
No, that's like a Dante-esque one, right?
It was, I don't even know. I read, like, 10 pages
that would
of
piss
it.
Me
it was one
I
that
read
came out
all
way
of
off.
The Divine Comedy and I would get pissed about that. But
honestly though, like the movie's not good. You should read it. I mean, it was a book I, you know, read in high school and I loved in high school. I actually want to reread it again because I think it'll be really entertaining. But I honestly think both of you would enjoy it, but you'd also have some really interesting insights. I think you'd like Mariah just said, they're entertaining. They really are.
I'm like, such a stickler, though, because, like, I had a professor when I studied abroad in Rome who was a Borghese. Like, she was from the family.
Whoa.
And was, like, a cool lady. And she's like, yeah, I've taught many courses on, like, how many ways the Da Vinci Code was incorrect. Being like, oh, you know, the secret passageway between the Vatican and Castel San Angelo? Like, it's not actually a secret passageway. It's just an open walkway. Mm-hmm. Like, anyone can see it. So maybe I read it, but
I mean, it's definitely romanticized and fictional.
Of course. Fictionalized. Of course it is.
But I still, it's one super easy read.
Of course.
It takes, like, no time.
And I mean, I almost think it's more important for you guys to read it because of that reason. Because, I mean, you might get mad, but, like, I think it'll be in a good way. I think it'll be in an interesting way.
Because I am not a stickler for, like, historical accuracy.
I have it upstairs right now, if you want it.
In, like, many things. But anything, like, Italian, Renaissance, Baroque era, I'm like, that's fucking wrong. Like, there was a Netflix original series on the Medici.
Yeah.
And, like, one of the women in it was wearing coral lipstick the whole time. And I was like, that shade was not available back then.
I started watching this Netflix series about, like, Marcus Aurelius and Commodus and the fall of Rome.
Oh, I saw that one too.
Yeah, I was watching that.
Fucking Commodus, man.
What a piece of shit.
Oh, I know. Like, it was really bad.
What a piece of shit. Anyways, that's really good. I'm gonna actually watch that after you guys leave.
Yeah.
But I think you should all read Da Vinci Code, and we should do a book club-esque episode.
I think
it'd be really interesting and fun for readers fun for listeners, because I'm sure a lot of them have read it.
Oh, for sure.
And no shame to those who have. I fucking loved it when I was younger. Like, I loved that book, and there are things about it that are super entertaining.
And it's okay to love it for people who don't like it.
Of course. I don't mean to sound like an asshole snob.
No,
I'm just very particular in, like, very few areas, and that's one of them.
I think most people, when it came to their field and their expertise, would feel the same way, but then we also just need to say that, like, we don't judge you for enjoying that stuff.
And, like, Dan Brown, I know he hasn't claimed to be, like, this is all accurate.
Yeah.
This is all real.
To be completely honest, though, like, trying to take something positive from it. Like I said, I read that book probably when I was 14 or 15, and I really loved it. And that was also at the time when art history was really, like, sparking for me.
Sure.
And so that book probably helped influence my path into art history.
Probably.
I never took it as, like, an actual source or anything. It did create this adventure around art history that made it very exciting for me.
I've heard that from
people. It's like Indiana Jones for art history.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
I appreciate Indiana Jones.
So we've gone on about a billion tangents already. Hieronymus. Let's focus. Okay. So, as I said, he was often confused for a Spanish painter because huge majority of his paintings belong to the Prado in Spain, which has created kind of a contention between Prado and, you know, the Flemish people.
Yeah.
They...
Understandably.
Yeah, yeah, because they don't own a single Bosch.
Yeah, that's
technically, yeah.
Was that the Habsburgs that bought most of the...
I'm not sure. Mm.
Oh, that would make sense, though, right?
That would make sense.
And then it just went to Spain rather than... Ah, that would be a really interesting history to follow.
See, I feel like...
I'll do a blog post on that, because that's something that I can do a blog post on.
Please do.
I will. I'll see if I can find the history of Bosch paintings with the Habsburgs and how they maybe ended up in the Prado.
Historically, that could be part of it.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
So there's a documentary on Netflix called Hieronymus Bosch, Touched by the Devil.
Black Phillip.
Trying to make a guess how we feel about this.
So, I mean, honestly, though, like, straight off the...
dramatic title.
Exactly. And this documentary...
You know, someone thought about that and was like, yes.
But that's the problem. If you're going to have a fucking dramatic-ass title like that, your documentary should probably have some drama in it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, but this documentary is so dry.
Yeah.
And it's, like, really... It was a huge bummer because this documentary was made in 2016. It was just made.
Yeah.
And it's about a fascinating artist.
Everything at their fingertips to make it glorious.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a fascinating artist. And in my opinion, I, like... I had to fast forward some parts. I was bored as shit. And it just kind of like, it just played into that stereotype of art history being boring.
Yeah.
The documentary, it follows the Bosch Research and Conservation Project,
okay,
which happened, as Natalie brought up earlier, at the 500-year centennial.
Quintennial.
So there was this big project of, I think it was maybe five art historians. One was like a physical art historian. Well, you know, like they all had their specialties. Oh, mm-hmm. Like, yeah. So, I mean.
You can get so deep.
Yeah. Like, it was really cool because there was a lot of footage of them, you know, with their special tools, like sure. looking at all these paintings
yeah.
up close.
Yeah.
So for that aspect, it's worth watching.
Mm-hmm.
Visually, mm-hmm. very interesting because you get this it's shot well, lots of cool images,
yeah,
and really high quality images of close-ups of Bosch works,
yeah,
which is important because Bosch is all about the details,
for sure.
He's such a detail artist, yeah. And so there's so many moments in this documentary of just, you know, some kind of cool weird music in the background, like instrumental music,
yeah.
and just scanning the details of these paintings, very high res,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So visually it is worth it. If you like Bosch, I would watch it and watch for those things and then maybe fast forward through the stupid bureaucratic bullshit that happens in between.
Yeah.
Because that was the problem with this documentary is there was so much bureaucracy. They did address the contention between Spain and the Netherlands over his work.
Yeah.
But not in a way that was particularly interesting or, like, sexy, which is, like, it's kind of an interesting, like, spat they're having.
Totally.
You think you could make that interesting. Wasn't really that interesting, at least the way they portrayed it.
Huh.
Except that, like, the Prado was like, yeah, we have all the Bosches.
Yeah.
Fuck you guys. Like, that's basically what it comes down to.
Right, right.
And then there was so many drawn-out scenes of just bureaucratic conversation dealing with this big Bosch exhibition.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even interesting. It was the type of stuff that if I worked this job, if I was a curator on this job, it's like the type of stuff that would be the stuff about my job I don't like. You know?
For sure.
Like, it would be
For
the
sure.
stuff that you have to kind of get through because it's part of working in the field.
For sure.
It's not worth watching.
Yeah.
Like, a lot
yeah.
of it, like, there was one scene where it was just, like, three curators deciding what name was going to go on a wall text. And it was like, why? Why?
No one wants to see
it was, not. So I was having these feelings about this documentary.
Sure.
And whenever I have strong feelings about a movie or documentary, whether it's really positive or negative, I go to Rotten Tomatoes. I'm a big Rotten Tomatoes fan.
Me too.
And I read other reviews.
Yeah.
Just because, well, I'm not a huge review person because I think sometimes critics are assholes.
Yeah.
I do it if I have strong feelings because I kind of just want to see what the general consensus is. And I went on, it didn't have a good rating, and I was reading some of the reviews, and there was one that I was just like, yes, exactly. And all it said, two words, curiously incomplete.
Wow.
And I was like, yes. Like, so it's really a documentary that had amazing potential. Like I said, visually speaking, amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's Bosch, so they had a lot of help.
Yeah.
Oh,
but
sure.
also just the film work is good.
Oh, for sure.
It's good
sure.
shots. There's, towards the end, there's these really cool shots of this, I think he's like a conservator, like
mm-hmm.
working very closely. And in like this dark room with like wood panels. It's a really beautiful shot.
It sounds beautiful.
Yeah. So there are, film-wise, there are very beautiful shots. So hats off to the filmography. Well done. And yeah, and if you're interested in high-res images of Bosch, definitely check it out. But all the in-between, quote-unquote, story
mm-hmm.
is really rough. Like, it's not about the history of Hieronymus Bosch. It's about how these paintings have been acquired.
Right.
It's about this battle between
totally.
Them. It's about this big exhibition that went up in 2016 that was almost complete. It didn't have Garden of Earthly Delights because
mm-hmm.
the Prado was like, it's too delicate,
mm-hmm.
which I don't know if I buy
Come
that.
On.
I think the Prado is probably just like, no, it's ours. But that's just...
Well, because also, wasn't this one of those instances where they didn't have anything to give back?
Yeah.
Which is a huge thing for those of you who aren't in art history or an art-related field. Like, museums, when they get blockbuster works, it's because they're giving something back to that institution. Definitely. Like, it's all about what you can trade, essentially.
It's all about pats on the back. It's all about,
you offer someone something a few years down the road to get something 10 years down the road. Like, it's...
Yeah, and I mean, I guess if you're really, really, and I mean, like, deeply interested in the bureaucracy of it, then maybe this documentary is worth it to you, because even though it's boring at times, there might be some things that are highlighted.
It's an interesting window.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. Potentially. You still might get bored at times, but, I'm not going to claim it was all lost. Like, it's, I don't want to be an asshole. Like, it wasn't, like, a piece of shit documentary by any means. It just wasn't what I expected it to be. So, one thing that does kind of come up in this documentary and elsewhere is that, so attribution is a big thing with Hieronymus Bosch. There are currently 25 paintings and 20 sketches that we believe to still be in existence by Hieronymus Bosch. Mm-hmm. That's what's attributed to him. However, he did have a workshop, and historians have concluded that he had a left-handed assistant, which is fascinating
to me. That is so detailed.
I know. Like, the fact that they can figure that out and they can tell the difference between a painting by his left-handed assistant and him.
It's like art forensics.
Exactly.
That
would have
been such a cool field if I was better at science. Yeah. I wish I was better at science, man.
Yeah. And that's definitely some of the people in this documentary are like art forensic-y people.
Absolutely.
And basically, a lot of these works have either been attributed to Bosch that were actually, like, misattributed and they should have been to his workshop, or it's also happened the other way around, where paintings have been attributed to the workshop of Bosch, you know, like this left-handed assistant, but they were found out to be Bosch's. For example, the Temptation of Saint Anthony sat in storage for decades at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art in Kansas City, Missouri. And it was, it was believed to have been from his workshop, but recently they attributed it to Hieronymus Bosch.
Yeah, it was one of five, right? There was like five in storage that were supposed to be of his workshop, and then they finally figured out, like,
it was him. Wait.
Oh, guys.
Just hanging out in Kansas City, man.
Dude, I don't know. There's a lot of good songs about Kansas City, so I feel like it's a cool place. I know that's it's not.
Kansas City's fine. I don't want to hate on Kansas City. That being said, I also haven't really checked out the art museums there. And I know for a fact that art museums in the Midwest can be surprisingly amazing. So I will not judge until I check out the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art in Kansas City, Missouri.
It's on our radar now.
So, Temptation of Saint Anthony, attributed to Bosch, was just hanging out there in their collection. Let's see. We kind of were talking about this earlier. Mm-hmm. Bosch had a thing for Saint Anthony. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, Nat?
I just noticed it in browsing my little HieronymusBosch.org website, where they have all of his works listed here, which fit into a neat five pages. Just kind of goes over the Bosch paintings, and as I'm scrolling through them, I noticed there were a lot of depictions of Saint Anthony, and so I, you know, came into this pre-recording being like, does anyone know his obsession with Saint Anthony? It seems oddly prevalent that he bears some connection. And then I was looking it up, and to add to the whole Spanish thing, I mean, Saint Anthony was not Spanish, but he was from Portugal. So that kind of adds to that whole Iberian area, like him being from there. It just kind of adds to the layers. So I could 100% see why people would think that. Not to mention that nothing about Bosch's style screams Northern Renaissance at all whatsoever. Yeah. But I also, I mean, sorry to jump off St. Anthony for a second, but I heard from somewhere that there was, maybe it had to do more with his workshop, but there was, like, a following of people painting in this style. Or, like, it wasn't pulled out of nowhere, necessarily. Mm-hmm. You said that Bosch came from a family of painters. From what I gathered, this was a cultivated style. It wasn't as random as some people like to treat it, necessarily.
Makes sense.
But I, again, haven't seen any evidence to prove that. So, who knows? But, yeah, he paints quite a few St. Anthony-themed paintings.
So the St. Anthony thing has an interesting connection in the sense that we gotta talk about it, because it's a theory, and it's a theory about every artist in the past that has done something weird. Mm-hmm. There is the theory that Hieronymus Bosch had ergot poisoning, which is why his work is so trippy. Because
ergot poisoning is what's linked with, like, a lot of the witch hunts.
Yes.
And, like, people thinking they were werewolves.
Yes. So ergot poisoning basically was very, very prevalent at this time. So, I mean, it's not an insane theory. It was very prevalent. It was very prevalent in this area at this time because it occurred in, like, bread.
That's right.
Yeah, in yeast.
That's right. They were all eating bread.
Yeah.
Everyone's
eating bread, and a lot of that bread had ergot in it, and ergot creates a effect very similar to LSD.
Oh, boy.
And so...
Those poor people.
So the thing that happened with ergot poisoning is, speaking as a historian, it's very common for historians to just look at anything insane and crazy and be like, it's probably what it was. Which is, it's interesting to me because it's like LSD has been around for a long time. And every time something crazy happens right now, we don't go, it's LSD, you know, even though LSD is around and very accessible.
For sure.
We don't automatically jump to it. Every time someone does something creative. So like, it's a little much, but that's a leading theory with the witch hunts, that there was ergot poisoning going on, so it led to things like hallucinations and crazy shit, basically.
Mass hysteria,
exactly. It was often referred to as St. Anthony's fire.
Right, which is really interesting.
It is very interesting.
Well, because that's what he died of, right?
Who?
St. Anthony?
Maybe.
Oh.
Look it up.
He wasn't like skinned alive or
rotated on a spike. Because that's it. Because when I saw that Bosch had this weird thing with St. Anthony, I started looking up facts on St. Anthony, and I'm pretty sure became sick with ergotism, a disease which is now known as St. Anthony's fire. So
Whenever I hear of a saint dying of, like, somewhat natural causes, that's always surprising.
I know, and the fact that he's so famous. But from what I gathered, I think he's famous because he's, like, the leading follower of St. Francis.
Right.
So that, I think, is why.
That's what's up with my boy, St. Francis, right up there. Aww. Love that dude.
Look at him with those dogs and the birds.
I know, he's
so gentle and docile.
He's just hanging out with the animals. Yeah. I fucking love St. Francis.
So people love St. Francis, and by extension, they loved St. Anthony. That's what I gathered.
And also apparently St. Anthony was tripping balls. So.
Yeah, seriously. It says that he went in a woodland retreat. Poor guy. He didn't see it coming. There he lived in a cell built for him under the branches of a walnut tree. Anthony died on the way back to Padua on the 13th of July, 1231, at the Poor Clare Monastery. According to the request, he was buried in a small church. Yeah, so it really doesn't give a lot about his death, but it sounds like he just died from that.
Well, we're going to do an episode
on drugs and art.
Yeah, we're going to do an episode on drugs and art. So we'll look more into this, and because I think that would be a really good approach, is like this whole ergot LSD thing and how similar are they actually. But the thing with ergot poisoning is, yes, it can be very bad for you. I mean, plenty of people had it and survived, but you can get very sick from it.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of the symptoms and stuff I'm reading make it sound like the psychosis stuff is minor and that most of it is like nausea and vomiting and like
poisoning,
spasms, diarrhea,
general poisoning.
Yeah.
Right. So what is that other, might be carbon monoxide. I think it is where you can get that and you have like visual and auditory hallucinations. Wait. And that can happen a lot when people think that their house is haunted or something.
Did you listen to that?
That was
This American Life or TED Radio Hour. It was one of the two.
What episode? Yes. I want to listen to this immediately.
I'll find it for you.
Yeah.
But it's really good. It's essentially about a girl who thinks that her little cottage, I think it's a cottage too. It's like a townhouse. Is haunted.
Yeah.
And she's truly convinced and like desperate and sad or whatever. And she eventually finds out that it's
finds like a
poisoning.
Ghost hunters board, but like for very pragmatic
like,
people. So first they'll ask you a bunch of questions like, do you have a carbon monoxide detector? Is it turned on? And that was what it was. And then she formed a podcast based off of that debunking ghost story things. And I want to listen to all of this.
She's great. She's fantastic.
I definitely...
Now we'll find it. I can't remember.
But I had that feeling. I was like, am I being poisoned when I'm living in the guest house? Because one of the symptoms is a feeling like pressure on your chest and a feeling of dread. That's how they describe it. So imagine, like, feeling that way. You're just anxious and stressed out, and you just, you feel like someone's watching you. It's like all the symptoms for carbon monoxide poisoning truly sound like you're being haunted.
That's so interesting.
So creepy.
Because, so I definitely have spent plenty of time watching, like, ghost hunting shows.
Oh, 100%.
Like, I was really into Paranormal State.
I was literally just going to say
that. Like, I love all of that shit.
Yeah.
But when I think about it, a lot of those places they go to visit are usually, like there's a lot of, like, trailers or, like, old-ass houses.
Decrepit. And yeah, like, not up to code.
Fuck, man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What if everyone just has carbon monoxide poisoning?
It's possible for probably it's at least possible. 50%.
That's so sad.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What if Bosch had carbon monoxide poisoning?
Was it possible? I don't think he did. Yeah, let's come back to because
this has been the most ranty episode.
Let's combat those theories that he's essentially tripping balls.
So, yeah, I think we should talk about that a little bit. It is a theory. There's a video I actually watched on it from How Stuff Works that I'll link to the website because it is interesting. It's a theory that he had ergot poisoning and he was just on drugs and that's what created all these characters, which very well could have contributed. It could have been a factor. It could have been something. It definitely could have. However, there are plenty of other things that could have been going on.
Yeah. The Garden of Earthly Delights, for example.
I feel like we could talk a lot about a lot of his works because, as we talked about, they're so detail-oriented and there's so many just weird things to look at. But Garden of Earthly Delights is the big one. Mm-hmm. It's the big guy. It is dated between 1490 and 1510. So once again, vague. It is a triptych. There is debate over whether it was used as an altarpiece or not.
Right, yeah.
Some people say it definitely was, and some people say, no, it wouldn't have been an altarpiece, it was too weird. So, I don't know.
I don't know. I just heard a very convincing argument that it actually was. And I have to, and this is my little combat to the whole ergotism thing. I just listened to a podcast, I'll link it to our sources, where this art historian discusses how every single element of the Garden of Earthly Delights can be associated to a line in Psalms.
I'm not sure.
Hold on.
The Bible.
Yeah, it's one of them, isn't it?
Somewhere in the Bible.
I want to say it's Psalms. It's probably Psalms because it's a P1 and it's not Proverbs. So it's Psalms.
Probably.
Okay. We're going to do that. It's Psalms.
That's Psalms is very poetic.
Yes. So. And apparently.
But I also feel like I'd imagine some of his
that
imagery.
That would make sense because it's the third in it. So it would be shortly after. Like,
I feel like some of his imagery, at least this is just, you know, me speculating, but that some of his imagery would come from Revelations.
Yeah.
What I would think.
I don't, probably, but I don't, but the Garden of Earthly Delights supposedly is straight out of Psalms and talking about, like, they talk about how it's either, like, foreboding what could happen or saying, like, what will happen because of the fall from the Garden of Eden and whatnot. And,
All that jazz.
But apparently in Psalms, I have not read it. Shame on me. I took a Old Testament class in undergrad, so I should know this. But describes, like, everything that he's describing, like, these absurd animals that are, like, out of proportion and seem to us so far from anything out of nature, but are apparently described in Psalms and can be related to these characters. So I thought that was super interesting.
For sure.
And this guy was saying, like, with pure confidence, like,
yeah,
I can tie each of these pieces to this book.
Yeah.
In the Old Testament. So Bible, I don't know.
The Bible, especially the Old Testament, has some
crazy stuff.
Pretty trippy shit in
yeah.
there. So
Bosch was a fascinating,
a very religious man.
And I love the idea that people look at Bosch's work and are like, this dude was nuts. And then it's like, no, dude, this is literally out of the Bible that you swear that you follow. And it's like,
the Bible's nuts.
I know, but people try and act like it's not.
I know.
And that to me is what's so fascinating.
Dude, I know.
Think about the context in which the Bible was written. I mean, right. There was a lot of shit going on.
Yeah. It's just, if you, I don't know. I don't understand saying you follow the Bible and not recognizing how fucking nuts it is. There's a lot of crazy stuff going on in there. And you could still, like, follow it. But
of course,
you have to admit that it's not cut and dry or clear or, like, you have to admit what's actually happening in that book is
it's not
pretty crazy. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So Garden of Earthly Delights, as we said, it's a triptych. If you haven't seen it, we'll have images. There's also, we'll link, there's a really great page where you can just explore the whole thing, like, up close. It's amazing. I've probably spent hours just, like, hanging out and, like, because there's so many details and you can actually, like, go into and explore the Garden of Earthly Delights. It's really cool. So we'll link that as well. But it's a triptych, 7 feet tall, 13 feet long. The center panel is 6.5 feet wide. So it's a big guy. The whole thing is very large. And it depicts, the first panel is, is it pre-fall or is it the fall? It's the fall. And then, so the fall from the Garden of Eden.
I think it's pre-fall and fall. Because
you're right. I think it's a mix of...
Yeah.
And then the middle panel is Earth, but, like, in a very... what's the word I'm looking for? Ooh. Kind of...
Apparently, Salmian.
Salmian?
Like the Psalms.
Salmian.
Apparently, according to
It's I mean, it's supposed to represent present existence on Earth, but not realistically, if that makes sense. Like, more, I think, in, like, a poetic, metaphorical sense. And then the third panel is essentially, like, what comes next. So hell is the easiest way to describe it, is hellfire and damnation.
And another interesting feature of the middle panel is supposedly, like, in the center, it's a little more, I mean, it's all nonsensical, but, like, it's supposed to kind of unravel as you get to the edges. So if you really pay attention to the figures and creatures and what they're doing and what they're made up of, in the middle, supposedly, they're more reasonable, I guess, and they become fringier as they get to the edges, like, it metaphorically kind of, like...
Well, the thing about the middle panel that is fascinating is, like, the middle panel looks like a fucking good time. Like, it's weird, but it's happy. It's like there's lots of weird creatures, and there's some, like, weird, like, sex stuff going on.
On the edges. Apparently, like, all the partnering and stuff gets more prevalent and obvious as you get closer to the edges. They're, like, subtle innuendos where people are, like, paired off and there's, like, more, like, sexual by nature.
Of all the panels, it has a much more pleasant vibe. It's colorful. It has a very Eden-esque quality. It's people enjoying themselves, but they are engaging in things that would potentially be frowned upon by traditional Christian doctrine. It's kind of like a, I don't know, in a lot of ways it's very, like, Bacchanalian. There's partying, but it's not, it's not depicted in a way that's like, oh, this is a ruckus and this is, you know, disgusting. It's, I don't know. When I look at the middle panel, I'm like, I want to go to that party. Like,
I'm looking at a beautiful scene right now with a guy in what can be described as... That's a yoga pose, and I can't remember what it's called. It's kind of close to puppy. It's a little different. And he has flowers coming out of his butthole.
He does.
He does. That he does. Yeah, right? They're just flowers sprouting out of his anus. What was I going to say? Oh, we should probably go back and mention, just for people who aren't familiar with this work, that it is, it's a triptych. And on the outside, so when the panels are closed, there is a grease eye painting, which just means that it's painted in gray. Essentially, if you saw it, you would think it looked like maybe pencil or like charcoal, but it's paint. And it's a sphere that's supposed to be kind of like the creation of the earth, right? There's a little god figure up in the left-hand corner, and it's him creating the earth, and he's speaking the words of creation. And I think that it's in the painting, it's like quoting what it says in Kings, whatever. You guys can tell I paid a lot of attention in that.
No, I was going to say, like, I think the outside is equally as fascinating.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
It's a really, like, it is supposed to depict, like, the creation of the universe. And in the left-hand corner, upper left-hand corner, there's an image of God. But, this is also in the 1400s, 1500s. Mm-hmm. And so it has this, just the imagery and the shapes that are used, it kind of has, like, a scientific feel. It kind of has an alchemical kind of a feeling to it. It's just this image of the world, like, being created by God, but you can also see this influence of science or alchemy.
For sure. And I mean, in general, a lot of times the paintings on, like, when a triptych or an altarpiece is closed, what's painted on the outside is just really interesting because you don't see it as much typically. Mm-hmm. But like that one, it's like, whoa.
And you can also look at that at the interactive Bosch thing. You can look at the outside as well. It's very cool. But yeah, so ultimately this painting, this triptych, is very super Christian, theological, dogmatic. Yeah. Like, he's dealing straight from the Bible.
Yeah.
His Christian ideals are coming through. However, I don't know, at least for me personally, what I connect to with this work and what I think a lot of people connect to with this work is there is some kind of this, like, empathetic connection to reality and to the human condition. Yeah. Like, it's not just, like, this religious painting at all. Like, it dives deep into the human existence of everything. And in a way that while he is setting up these three panels and he's setting them up in accordance with the Bible and what it says will happen to the sinners, I feel like these images aren't always, I don't know, they're not necessarily foreboding or scary all the time. Even though they're weird, like, there's just a sense of embracing the human condition within it, which I think, as far as religious artwork goes, is definitely way before its time.
For sure.
To be able to just, to create a triptych that's definitely biblical, like undeniably biblical, but yet taps in to something about human existence that's so present and complicated and not just strictly how it comes from the Bible. There's something very human that comes through in the work, in my opinion.
Yeah, totally. And another kind of side note-y thing is, like, it's so easy to look at the work and consider it to be so, like, fantastical, like, that things are so made up. And I think it, again, I need to look into the biblical references, like the direct ones with the figures and everything, because I heard from good authority that they're there. I have not read it myself. But also this tree that's in the left panel that looks completely made up, if you look at it, apparently is based on a very real tree called a dragon blood tree. And it's supposed to be exactly based on this tree.
Interesting.
And let's see. That looks pretty similar.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's a trippy looking tree, and supposedly that's what the tree looks like when it's cut. It bleeds this red, oozy, stuff that looks super like blood, cool. And that's where it gets its name. From the research I've done, it seems like a lot of stuff in Bosch's paintings can be directly related to real things. So this whole, like, LCD trip, like,
stuff. To be fair, though, I totally agree. But once again, I don't know what it's like to have ergot poisoning, like, so it could have been a completely different thing.
You've lived a good life.
But the thing about psychedelic drugs is that, as I said before, is they bring new perspective to things that exist.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I agree that just saying, oh, he was on drugs, like, that's, you know, you should think about it more than that. Like, I think that's a very dismissive way to look at it.
For sure.
Or, oh, he had ergot poisoning. Like, it's dismissive. And many of these things, like you said, they came from the Bible. They came from real life. That being said, I don't think that's proof that he wasn't on drugs.
Right.
Because I think drugs could very much influence creating very animated characters that come from a real place.
Sure.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So I think
that's a good way to put it.
Like, because, like, you're right, that tree does resemble this tree. Yeah, it resembles this tree in real life. But it also isn't, like, it's in his own style. It's different. It doesn't realistically depict the tree.
Mm-hmm.
It's clearly based on the tree.
Yeah.
But that doesn't, in terms of the drug conversation, you could be tripping and looking at a tree and create, you know, put it in a painting in a slightly more stylistic way. That's entirely possible.
Sure.
So, once again, you shouldn't just, like, write Hieronymus Bosch as, like, oh, he's crazy, he was on drugs, or he was, you know, because that's stupid. But also, it is possible that it maybe there was some ergot in his bread, and it maybe opened his eyes a little.
Just a little bit of ergot.
Yeah,
exactly. Small dosing.
Micro-dosing, not ergot. Exactly.
And we would have no way to know, which is the fascination of
Exactly.
Because there is, just aesthetically, there's something slight, you know, somewhat otherworldly about his work. And so it does make sense to me, this idea that maybe he was, you know, his mind was open in certain ways.
Yeah.
But it's also not proof that it was either.
And it comes to the problem of, like, projecting modern day thoughts on people of a different time. Exactly. I know we talked about this with in terms of The Baroque, and I'm sure we have in other podcasts, but, you know, we can't do that. We can't look at the 60s and then try and project that onto someone.
Right. Exactly.
In the Renaissance.
Gotta look at it with period eye. Yeah. Quote Baxendall.
I would also like to know if there have been a lot of tests on the similarities between LSD and ergot. Like, how similar were they? How different were they?
I can't imagine that they were. They seem to be just such wildly different compounds.
Yeah.
That it would be surprising to me if they did. I mean, maybe ergot has some more similarities to, like, shrooms.
Well, that would make sense, too. I also wanted to briefly talk about, so in the third panel of Garden of Earthly Delights, which is the Hellfire panel, there is an image towards the center of a cracked eggshell man.
Yeah. I love that guy.
That has been thought to be a self-portrait of Hieronymus Bosch. And it does stand out. It's not an image, like, you don't see another image like that in the entire triptych. It's a very, just this little guy peeking out.
Yeah, I'd love to know if there was a depiction of that in Psalms.
I know, right?
Like, it's that was written out, because I would love to hear that visually described.
It's definitely different than the other imagery in this portrait of a man kind of peeking out right in the center of the third panel. And I wanted to bring up, like, what do you guys think it says that, if it's true, if it's a self-portrait, what do you think it says that he painted himself in the Hellfire?
This kind of reminds me of back in the Bad Boys of the Baroque when we were talking, wasn't it Bad Boys Baroque, I think? We were talking
about an artist putting themselves in a self-portrait. The other thing I'm thinking of, it's not Baroque, but Michelangelo puts his self-portrait on the skin of the...
Because of the bee, right?
Saint...
Bartholomew.
Yeah,
Saint Bartholomew.
And that's like a Last Judgment scene, so that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. It's
just like he's just peeking out.
Yeah,
it's like
because it's very casual the way that it looks. It's not like
he's not in pain or upset, but it's like, why would he put himself in that panel? Though?
I don't know.
You know,
he's such a mysterious
so
dude.
So much mystery.
Yeah,
so
I really don't know what to make of that. If that is him. I mean, I don't know. Like, what would you be trying to say with that?
I mean, I guess, like, maybe I'm trying to piece it together, but, like I said, I do think there's something about his work and Garden of Earthly Delights that's very human and very connected to humanity, and I don't know, maybe as many humans and many devout Christian humans experience, maybe he was kind of placing himself in this place of, like, we're all sinners and we're all, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's a good idea. I mean, so much of his work deals with, like, moral decay and not necessarily, like, the way that a lot of artists approach it. I don't know. It's not, like, a big, like, guilt-ridden, so dark, whatever, but his art resides in that zone of dealing with human fallacy and, like, moral depravity and things like that, and not necessarily from a judgmental standpoint, but just, like, approaching it and, like,
for sure
painting scenes associated with it.
Yeah, and I think that's also seen in the center panel, because there's a lot of argument over whether the center panel is it joyous? Is it meant to be judged? Is it, you know, is it meant to express a celebration of earthly pleasures? Is it meant to be a judgment of earthly pleasures,
so
there's the fact that there's so much wiggle room there and that he doesn't give you a clear message is very interesting.
It
to
is.
Me. Because if at the end of the day, what if Hieronymus Bosch is just saying, like, fuck it, we're all going to hell?
Yeah, right?
Like, well, that's a possible message.
And what's
interesting,
apparently the owls in the painting are meant to symbolize the devil versus using the traditional snake metaphor.
Which is really interesting.
Yeah, which I liked, though, because it kind of fits better, because owls are, like, they're nocturnal. You know, they come out at night. They're quiet. They're mm-hmm. always watching. They've got these big eyes. They swoop down and, like, attack their prey. Like, they are very kind of...
I usually think of owls as being very wise.
But yeah. Yes. But that's, like, taught. So there's owl in the left panel that's, like, tucked away in the little center of that pink form. There's an owl in this... Two owls in the center, at least. Probably more because there's lots of birds. But I don't see any in the double panel. Or double panel.
The devil panel.
Double panel.
It's
on
the
that note.
Devil. Yeah, I think I saw maybe an interview or something about the whole owl thing, which was really interesting because, yeah, they're typically, at least at this time, considered to be like sinister type figures. And at this point in history, that is what they represent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but
yeah.
Someone also brought up that these owls... Like, the way he paints them, and he paints them in a lot of paintings, like, not just Garden of Earthly Delights, he really likes the owl figure, mm-hmm. is that he paints them in a very, like, curious, watching, almost, like, wise kind of way.
Yeah,
so it's, good. Like, yeah, so it's, like, in a gentle way,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
it's, like, so are we dealing with something sinister, are we dealing with something calm that just observes, are we dealing with both?
You know?
It's kind of cool to have the devil personified as something, though, that's, like, not instinctively threatening, because I feel like that's much more realistic with, like, the devil's character.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Like,
for sure.
The devil doesn't, like, run around just trying to scare the shit out of people. Like, he's, like, sneaky and subtle and just, like, always there watching and, like, waiting for the right moment and... Creepy.
Black Phillip.
Ended our day with
Never forget.
Do we have any other thoughts on
Bosch points?
I mean, there's so much to say about him, and like there's so much mystery surrounding him.
The mystery around him is kind of unlike. I'm trying to think if there's another artist that comes to mind that is mysterious as Bosch. And
I don't know.
I'm not coming up with one.
No.
Yeah, and it is partially because we have so little knowledge of his life.
Right. And
so whenever that happens with historical characters,
you're just like, oh my God.
I'm going to fill in all the blanks.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, I guess those are some of our thoughts on Bosch. There's a lot more directions to go. We didn't even talk about a lot of his works. But if you have any thoughts or things you'd like to... contribute, email us at arthistorybabes@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Should we do a couple listener mails?
Yeah. I have one pulled up from a girl in junior high. All right. This is from Heather. Hey, guys. So I'm a junior in high school. Oh, junior in high school. Because I was like, wow, she says junior high. Only my dad calls it that still. Like, usually people say middle school. Okay. She's in high school. Sorry, Heather. I just saw junior and then high school and went from
there. We're used to skimming.
Yeah.
We've done a lot of skimming.
Hey, guys. So I'm a junior in high school and I love listening to y'all while I'm in the car and when doing art. So I plan on taking an AP high school art history class this year, and I'm very excited to learn more about it, but also super nervous about staying on top of studying and note-taking for the course. I was wondering if y'all had any tips on how to stay on top of studying and note-taking for art history, also any resources, books, websites, other podcasts that could also further educate me on the topic and help make the class a little easier for me. Thank you so much for reading this, and thanks for making me laugh to myself. Yes, making me look insane to passerbys during every podcast. Love with a lot of ease,
aww.
Y'all. And a smiley face.
It's so sweet.
That is sweet. That's cool that your class had... My high school did not even have art history.
I had AP art history.
I had an art appreciation class, which was kind of art history.
For sure.
But not quite the same thing.
If you haven't listened to our... Did we just call it art school?
Art history school.
Art history school episode.
And the bullshit episode, too.
And the bullshit episode. God. The art history school episode and our bull-s episode. I feel like I've said shit too many times this episode. Saying it again. Anyways, those ones we all give some tips on that, but just kind of like off the cuff. When you're in class taking notes, like usually your teacher will indicate what images are, whatever one that they talk about the most, that's what you want to take notes on. And when you take initial notes, unless they give you like a slide ID thing where they give you like the artist, the title, the date, all that. If they don't do that, definitely write that down and then talk about the context in which it was made, you know, any prevalent details that your teacher says. What else?
A good tip that we got from one of our professors was to take your notes as thoroughly as you can during the class. So do everything that Jenny just said. And then after class, spend like a solid hour sitting down and filling in what you remember and you didn't have time to jot down while it's fresh on your mind.
Yeah.
So if you read through your own notes right after, things will click that you still remember but didn't get a chance to write down because it's too quick. It can double your information just in that moment. Whereas if you try and do it right before the test weeks later, it's not going to come back to you the same way.
For sure.
So it's probably something that won't be easy right away, but if you get in the habit of it, it would be a great habit to have.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And like for studying for exams, if you can make flashcards where you print out little images, glue it on like one side of the flashcard and on the other have, you know, artist, title, date, all that, and then like maybe just a couple sentences more about what it is. If you don't want to like print all of them out, what I used to do was just make a PowerPoint presentation just for myself where one slide would have the image and then I'd go to the next slide and it would have all that info. So like the image would come up and I'd be like, okay, this is, you know, like the wave. I'm like, I don't want it. Okay. Hokusai. Like, oh. So you can test yourself.
Yeah. There's also a lot of apps now.
Yeah.
Apps and websites totally. That are free where you can download images into one side of the flashcard and put the information on the other, which we
did
not. Do
we remember the names of those? Because they weren't around when
There was one.
I think they're hard to find.
Quizlet.
Quizlet? Oh, I remember Quizlet. Yeah.
Quizlet.
We mentioned that in the Art History School episode.
Yeah.
Because there was another one I used, I think, first year of grad school.
I was going to say.
So there are plenty of them.
Yeah.
So yeah, you can do PowerPoint, you could. I like the physical ones are kind of fun, but there's plenty of ways to put it on your phone so you can practice when you're just like sitting at the DMV or something.
Totally.
But definitely if you haven't listened to those two episodes, because I think we went to a lot of information and tips and things,
for sure.
Among other things. But yeah. But there's
some meat to pick out.
Yeah, there was some good information in there.
But
so
yeah. And like Khan Academy.
Oh yeah.
You find them on YouTube. They're pretty good. They do a lot of different things. So you could certainly find what you need from them. Other podcasts, I mean, we're the best. Art Curious is good.
Mm-hmm.
Art Detective is the one I was listening to.
I haven't listened to Bosch.
I hadn't either, but they had a Bosch episode. And
Art Detective.
Really, it's a Oxford graduate is the host, and then she brings new people on every week. She's got an adorable English accent, and from the one episode I listened to, did not seem like overly pretentious or anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's also State of the Arts. They haven't released anything in a long time, but they have quite a few good ones as well. So there are other ones, and I there's lots of resources out there. The internet's an amazing place.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Another
best of luck. Yeah.
Yeah. Good luck to you. Thank you for writing another quick listener mail. Subject, you guys are awesome. Art history rules. Dance is cool.
Wow.
I agree with all of those things.
They just spoke right to your heart.
They did. Yeah. That's why I wanted to read this one. Hey, art history babes. First off, just wanted to say I love the podcast. You guys are all super cool and bring such life to the show and the subject matters you discuss. I just recently listened to your Euro Babes show, and it was so sweet to hear about all of your adventures, especially the exhibition at Musée d'Orsay, which I also recently attended myself.
Aww.
Secondly, I am a recent dance major and art history minor graduate, and my head's a swirl with interests and potential topics of research. Girl, I feel you.
Yeah.
Being a dancer and self-proclaimed art history buff, I tend to be drawn to both the intersection and relationship of the two subjects. I was wondering if the babes would be interested in doing an episode on dance, performance art, the relationships of artists and dancers, or anything along those lines that spark your interests. I love learning, so even if you guys don't do an episode, I'm super open to any resources you guys already have and would be willing to share with me. Again, love the show and keep up the awesomeness, Brie. So yeah, this message just like spoke to my own heart. My last couple years in undergrad, I pretty much did nothing but take dance classes and art history classes.
Yep,
so like, that's just like, my life. Yep. So all of those things. I'm super interested in performance art, very into the intersection of dance and art. There are some really just cool examples of stuff like modern stuff, like Kandinsky did a lot with like modern art and minimalism. A lot of famous minimalism was influenced by modern dance. And so there's just like a lot of really interesting intersections there, especially from the past century. So definitely we'll put that on the docket, future dance related episodes, because there's so many different routes we could go with that. So thank you for your message, Bree. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Bree.
Very sweet and thoughtful. If you have any thoughts for us, email us at arthistorybabes@gmail.com. Check out our Patreon for bonus episodes. Yes. Patreon.com/arthistorybabes. You will have access to extra episodes. It's really dope. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. You can write us a review on iTunes and we will be forever grateful. All of that stuff. Check us out. We're around. You guys are awesome.
Goodbye.
We are History Babes.
Like, there was a Netflix original series on the Medici.
Yeah.
And, like, one of the women in it was wearing coral lipstick the whole time. And I was like, that shade was not available back then.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.